Friday edition of the Don't Time Basketball podcast. Got a Reddit mailbag. Always like doing these. Let's just get in depth a little bit more than we normally would on some of these questions. Actually prepare some answers. Also got some news to get to. Let us begin with that right now, Danny. Oh, actually, no, we're not going to begin with that yet because I forgot to mention that we're sponsored today by Blue Apron. Get your first three meals free at blueapron.com/capspace is the URL. And also a new sponsor today, policygenius.com. Life insurance made easy, free quotes, zero hassle, and peace of mind. Policygenius.com is where you can get started with them. Now we are ready for some news, Danny. I apologize.
I don't know if Derrick Rose used Blue Apron on his off day, but it certainly would have been a good use of his time. And that saga is certainly continuing with the Knicks that now, I think Ian Begley was reporting that he is looking for a max contract.
So am I. yeah, I guess everyone has made that joke at this point, but it's really, and then he came back and played okay. I think he has played okay so far this season. He's been one of their top three players, which is perhaps damning with faint praise. This is definitely a concern. I know a lot of people were upset that Phil Jackson didn't address things at all. The Knicks were very embarrassed, just had to report that he just was quote unquote not with team an hour before the game, and they realized that he wasn't going to show up and no one could find him. He went back to Chicago for supposedly a family situation, then arranged help through the Knicks to get back to New York the next day. Didn't really apologize in his public comments afterwards, just described it as a family situation. I mean, you can at least apologize for not letting anyone know where you were. All you would have had to do is just, I mean, this is the case all the time that like people make up family reasons. Maybe it was a legitimate family reasons. Who knows? As long as you just let the team know in advance, everything would have been fine.
Exactly. There's a fundamental communication issue that happened here, and it ties in with some of the other concerns about Rose. And I guess you could group it as reliability, you know, that's physical and also just kind of the mental state component of it. And so he is going to be a free agent, and the Knicks got this trial run. And I think that's part of the reason why they wanted it in the first place, was to see how this worked, because he is a potential player they could agree to a long-term deal with. And I think they know a lot more now than they did before.
Rose is someone who I loved living in Chicago back when I was still a fan. He won the 2011 MVP for the Bulls. One of my favorite players to watch ever, certainly in the top five back when he was healthy. And therefore, I was certainly predisposed to really like the guy and to want to defend him through all the issues. I thought that if he didn't feel right, he made the right decision not coming back from the torn ACL at the end of that 2013 season if he didn't feel right. But obviously, he has not been able to stay healthy since. His conception of where he is in the NBA has been far too high for the status of player that he has been post-knee surgery. They pretty much, the people around him and he himself, have tried everything to get him back to this level. He's never reached that level. Vince Goodwill had a good piece, actually, that maybe a lot of these little irregularities are part of him having to come to terms with the fact that he is, you know, just kind of at best an average starting point guard in this league now. And things like this legal situation that he had, though he was found not liable, there are just so many little things. His comments that really he's shown a total lack of understanding for the effects that his comments will have in the media, even if perhaps he's really doesn't mean things in the way that it comes off in the media. He still has not been very smart in his public comments. So you can at the very least say that. So it's been a sad story for Rose, just this, and this being the latest indication that, you know, he may be more troubled than it perhaps appeared that he was when he was really the antidote to LeBron James supposedly being selfish, which of course was BS back in the Miami days. But he's the one that everyone latched onto, and now for whatever reason, he has not been able to really live up to what everyone thought he would be on or off the court early in his career. Should we move on?
To a player who has a different but some similar reputational elements, DeMarcus Cousins. There was reporting, I believe the first person who had it was James Hamm, about the prospect of DeMarcus Cousins agreeing to a designated veteran exception, which will not come into play until the new CBA.
Yeah, and not a surprise, I think, that this leaked, because it's been another bad Kings season. There's been more crap around Cousins. This is a deal that is so large, $207 million over 5 years, about $60, $70 million more than he could get elsewhere, and getting it sooner as well. I mean, he would be a fool not to sign this from a financial standpoint. standpoint. We could talk more about this a little bit, though, because we do have a question on this one. But I think just the timing of the announcement is, hey, Kings fans, you know, we're going to keep this guy around. And even though he can't actually sign it yet, a little weird to agree to it now. I mean, what if, like, you know, he has another implosion or an injury or, I mean, to say that publicly and even... there's been an acknowledgement, I think, even from Vlade Divac officially saying that, you know, we can't do it yet. We can't talk about it yet. But I mean, to have this out there, now you're almost boxed in, especially a team that is very concerned from a public relations standpoint. But there's an important component to this to remember, too. And this is something that Kevin Arnovitz noted on a podcast last week, is this Kings team is making a lot of money right now, despite the fact that they haven't been successful in the court. From a business standpoint, the new arena, they don't want to mess that up. And even if rebuilding with Cousins, trading him might have been the right move, that's probably going to be a bad contract by the end of it. You would think, for guys who are kind of in the lower end of the top 10 in the league, top 15 type of players in the league, not like the absolute best guys at the age that he is. But hey, they're making money. And if DeMarcus Cousins is the only reason to come and see this team,
it would also be brutally hard for them to find another DeMarcus Cousins, because they would have to fall enough in the draft to get somebody and then nail that pick. And they haven't done a lot of nailing picks recently.
Something we saw in person last night that we're keeping an eye on, haven't seen any reporting on this yet. Kentavious Caldwell-Pope had been having some issues with his left shoulder, according to Chris Haynes. Ran into a Zaza Pachulia pick, did not look good at all. Like he had the left shoulder just dangling there. They put a towel over his head on the sidelines. I mean, I don't know whether it got dislocated or not, what the deal was. It's just being called like a strain or a bruise or something like that. But it definitely looked like it wasn't just like, oh, he hit it. Like he was holding it like, okay, this thing is like really messed up when he came to the bench. So here's hoping that the damage isn't too bad. But I mean, just looking at it, don't want to speculate too much, but it looked like something that could potentially be an issue. And if he's out, he's going to miss significant time. That's it for the Pistons making the playoffs.
Were you the one who made the point, I think you were on Twitter, that he might be their most indispensable player?
I think he is their most indispensable player. He might even be their best player, in fact, because they just don't have anyone else who can defend and shoot threes on that team on the wing.
I agree with that. And his versatility defending ones and twos makes Reggie Jackson a lot more palatable. Jackson is a talented player, but has some specific flaws, and KCP papers over some of those.
Yeah, and Stanley Johnson has been awful so far in his career offensively. I think he has some potential, but if he is to now play 30 minutes a game, again, they're going to be in big trouble. What else we got here?
David Griffin and the Cavaliers made an interesting decision. I'm not criticizing it by saying interesting. I'm just saying interesting. To, instead of maintaining the Anderson Varejao larger trade exception, to make the structure of the Kyle Korver trade to generate smaller trade exceptions. And the most logical reason for this was just that the Varejao exception was expiring a little bit before the deadline this year, and David Griffin knows exactly what he could probably get for that. These are discussions that Cleveland has been looking at all year, and presumably didn't see anybody for that full, I think it was around $9.8 million, that was going to be possible.
Yeah, they've done this rolling over quite a bit. You remember this trade exception started with Brendan Hayward's non-guaranteed contract, and then that got rolled over into Varejao. When you have a trade exception, as long as you can find somewhere else to send the players, you can actually just eat into your trade exception and then create a new one for the value of the guys that you send out. That's what they did here. So the Varejao trade exception was 9.6. Now that's probably down to about 3 million or so, or now that they've gotten Korver in. And then the smaller ones are created each individually by the salaries of Mo Williams and the salaries of Mike Dunleavy. So they've got one that's like 4.8, another one is 2.1, but they do last longer. And I think this is an understanding, because they didn't have to do it this way. They could have just matched the salaries with Korver and maintained the entire trade exception. I think it's an indication that, number one, they probably don't want to pay another $50 million this year, which if they just straight took on 9.6 million salary, that's what they'd have to do. And perhaps even more so, that there just isn't a player out there that they could acquire for the assets that they have that's going to be so good that it's worth paying that extra $50 million, or even that he would be that much better than someone on the veteran buyout market, in which they are sure to be active.
The one player that I thought would have been a nice fit, and I don't know if Phoenix was going to give him up for what Cleveland has, is PJ Tucker. PJ Tucker now does not fit, based on my numbers, into the existing existing exceptions, but he also, you never know what's going to happen with that. And it's just one player. Maybe they've had discussions that led them to believe he wouldn't be an option.
Yeah. And part of the ammo that they would have used to acquire such a player with that trade exception was that another first round pick. And they'd have now given that up to get Korver. So it looks like that's the big bullet here. And now they at least have a smaller trade exception that'll last for a while. The salaries are growing so much that what you're going to be able to get with a $4.8 million trade exception, pretty small at this point, but at least it lasts for a little bit longer to a point where it might be realistic for them to use it next season when we don't really know what the landscape is going to be. Let's talk about the Clippers here before we move on to the mailbag.
Two small pieces for them. The more important one is that Blake Griffin is on track to return the last week of January per Kevin Arnovitz, who I believe, you know, that was from Doc Rivers. I think there was a quote in everything. That's good news for the Clippers that he's still on schedule to come back at that time. Certainly an important part of their team, and they would love to finish better than the four seed, and they're going to need him if they're going to try to get past that.
Yeah, and then KG was hired by the Clippers as a consultant. A lot of people have really been wanting him, apparently. I mean, I don't think that this is going to be any more important than, say, like Steve Nash being a consultant with the Warriors, but yeah, I guess it just makes the organization look good, if nothing else. But KG lives out in the LA area anyway, so if he was going to do this with someone, it makes sense it'd be the Clippers and his former coach, Doc Rivers, former teammate, Paul Pierce.
Yep.
So this is the first time that we've had occasion to talk about life insurance on this show. Do you have it? If you don't have it, why haven't you? Is it a hassle? Is it too expensive? That was the case for me, actually. I don't really have it. I used to have it through the firm. I don't now. Granted, I'm single, but I really need to get it. And the first place I'm going to look for it now is policygenius.com. PolicyGenius.com. There's no jargon, no sales pressure, no hassle. And if you go to policygenius.com today, you can save over 70% off other prices for life insurance. Policy Genius gets life insurers to compete for your business. That's how you can save money. They have the most accurate quotes from the top A-rated life insurance companies, and they've placed over $5 billion in life insurance for people like you, even though I know we have unique listeners. I'm sure some of the people that they've placed life insurance for are like our listeners. The big appeal here, other than the competition among insurers, is a very simple user-friendly website to shop and compare all the top-rated life insurance companies and give you the best options. Their customer service team, all of them are licensed experts in the field. They can help you find the best policy at the best price. And they also have other insurance offerings like health insurance, even pet insurance, which with two cats, I'm going to look at as well. So go to policygenius.com for life insurance made easy. Free quote, zero hassle, peace of mind. Don't wait. Go to policygenius.com today. Where do you want to start here? Got some good Reddit mailbag questions.
Let's go with so-so bored at work. Who gets a bigger contract next season, Derrick Rose or Ian Clark?
Be Rose.
Yep.
Clark isn't that good. He is in the absolute best place to succeed. He does not have the size to guard shooting guards. He's acceptable-ish against point guards, not someone who can finish at the rim at all unless he's on a wide open backdoor cut or a fast break. He can shoot the ball, but his low release is not really something that works very well when you've got tight defense on you. Not going to run a pick and roll at all. So he really needs a lot more next to him to be a main player of a team. You know, I'm thinking that Clark's going to get like $4 million a year if he's lucky, that type of thing. And Rose is still a lower end starting point guard. We're going to talk about him a little bit more. In fact, maybe we should get to that question right now from Barkevius Mimo. Which teams are most likely to get into the Derrick Rose bidding war, in quotes, this summer? Where would you like to see him?
My ideal solution for Rose would be a situation where he can be the starter but doesn't have to be, where maybe they have another option. So one of the teams that is a possibility is Dallas. Let's say Dallas drafts a point guard in this draft, which they very well could. That combination with, especially, they would still have Seth Curry, could really work if Deron Williams wants to go elsewhere. In terms of system fit, I don't really have any clear-cut ideas because his limitations shooting and limitations off the ball are certainly present, and I don't think that he's the best creator, so I don't have a particular like, oh, he would be perfect here.
Yeah, you think of him in Dallas because that's been a place where point guards have come to resurrect their careers to the extent that Dirk Nowitzki can still be the force that he's been, and he's started playing a little bit better lately. And if he sticks around, Rose running pick and roll with him, it would be good. They get a little more spacing as well. Now, Dallas may not have that much money, depending on what happens with Dirk. If he comes back for anything like what he's making this year, they're only looking at maybe 10 or 15 million. But that's probably going to be Rose's market, and it'll be interesting to see. You could see him as kind of the new Rajon Rondo in some ways. I think he's better than Rondo still, or even as Rondo was in these last couple of years. But as a guy with a big ego, is going to want to try to get somewhere to rebuild his value. Because when I really went through the teams, just about the only teams that I could think of outside of Dallas that are going to have space for what he's going to be looking for. And I mean, he's still going to be looking for at least eight figures a season, obviously. You know, the max is ridiculous. Brooklyn and Sacramento, the only ones I could come up with that have unsettled point guard situations where he could actually be an upgrade, or at least about similar to the incumbent, because a lot of these teams either have young guys, don't have space, aren't really in a situation where they would want to bring him in. I mean, doesn't he seem like a perfect fit in Sacramento? I mean, perfect in the sense that it's the kind of move that they would do.
Also a Calipari guy like DeMarcus Cousins. So even though they didn't go to the same school, they have that connection. And this question made me think about something I'm going to be really watch closely this summer, which is the timing of everything. So last year we saw the whole issue with the Bulls of Rondo agreeing with Rondo before they actually thought Wade was a possibility. This year, I think that's going to be whether the trade market and free agency for point guards happen at the same time. So if Goran Dragic is on the market at that point, if he doesn't get traded by the deadline and Miami decides to move him then, will that happen before players like Derrick Rose decide? The Suns' whole point guard morass, like if they make a decision with Brandon Knight or Eric Bledsoe, not at the draft time, but around then, because that could close up a couple of these openings. And depending on who gets moved, some of those players might have more palatable contracts than Derrick Rose will get.
Yeah, and Rose will be well behind some of the other guys in the pecking order. Jrue Holiday, Kyle Lowry, George Hill, Jeff Teague probably, although I think Rose and Teague are actually not that different in terms of players, and they're about the same age too. But I think with all the crap that comes along with Rose, that Teague will be ahead of him in the pecking order at age 29. So a lot of dominoes are going to have to fall before
God, if Jeff Teague went somewhere else and Rose ended up in Indiana, just have a greater exacerbation of the same issues.
Yeah, and we'll see. This list could certainly expand once, if Holiday leaves New Orleans, if Hill were to leave Utah, not that Rose would go to Utah, but that could cause some other dominoes to fall. Teague in Indiana, as you mentioned, and Chris Paul and Kyle Lowry as well. You think they're probably going to stay put, but and then so even some of the lower end guys, Darren Collison, Patty Mills. I mean, even Rose to me might even be behind Patty Mills in the pecking order personally. And then you get down into like Darren Collison, Darren Williams, who just, I mean, I think Rose actually, at least, I mean, the one thing that Rose can point to is he's at least stayed healthy so far this year. So he's got that going for him at least, you know, so maybe the injury questions won't dog him quite as badly if he can maintain this throughout the year, which, as we know, is only halfway done.
Next question is from Finesser. If Adam Silver removed the three-point line at the beginning of this season, who would be the top four teams in each conference and who would win the championship?
Yeah, this is an interesting question about just what would it do to basketball to not have a three-point line anymore. The fast break would become way more important. Offensive rebounding would become way more important. Post-ups would again become way more important. How much would it really matter to have spacing for guys like Steph Curry, Klay Thompson? I mean, I think two-point jump shots, you know, teams, guys like that who can still shoot 40% on threes, that's what teams shoot on mid-rangers. So I think guys could still space out that far and need to be guarded out there. And so that having the spacing would help. And Golden State just has so many good basketball players as well. Is that a regular landline phone right there?
Yes, because I'm an old person.
Oh, man. So I still think that having shooting would help. Having shooting has always helped to spread things out. I think the three teams really that show up to me that would be helped by this: San Antonio, because they shoot a ton of mid-rangers anyway, and they've got like a lot of post-up guys. They've got a fair amount of size. Memphis, of course, has been used to playing without three-pointers basically for a long time, although they're actually around league average this year. And then the Clippers actually do not shoot a ton of threes. Really, Redick is their only consistent three-point threat on their team. And then you'd have to downgrade Golden State and Cleveland significantly. Maybe Milwaukee and other and OKC teams that would look a little bit better. Toronto as well. Like teams that have guys who could create their own mid-rangers and post up are going to look a lot better. The pick and roll game would be much less effective without three-point shooters spreading it around.
I was thinking about the Rockets being a team that would be hurt a lot by this.
Yes, that's a good one too, yeah.
While their guys are comfortable shooting, the surplus of that distance is substantially different. And the Clippers benefit a lot also because their switch-heavy system that they've gone to a little bit more this year, I think it would work better without a three-point line, and they could, you know, compress that space a little bit defensively and do a good job.
Yeah, I think too that teams that like to switch, switching would be a lot less effective because you would just have much more and I think we've never seen no three-point line and zone defense a lot. I mean, that scoring would just go in the toilet with that. And actually, this is a good chance to get to a couple of these other questions too. The first one I wanted to go to is from Wow Good Stats. He's basically saying, like, why shouldn't we move the three-point line back, and is there too much three-point shooting? And my response to that is no, there's not, because that makes having the three-point game is what makes the two-point game look a lot better right now too. If you didn't have as many three-pointers and spacing wasn't as important, now you're just going back into post games and offensive rebound, and it's all a big slog and offense goes way down.
Also, if you move the three-point line back, attacking, doubling big men and all that post-up stuff would get nastier too. Like, it wouldn't even be as enjoyable even if it got accentuated.
Yeah, I mean, having threes makes posting up more effective, and when you consider that zone defense is allowed now, I mean, I have no idea how anyone would really be able to score when you consider how athletic these guys are at this point. And then another good question in that same vein from Beep Meep: create a cohesive lineup of players who are below average three-point shooters for their respective positions.
This was fun. I really enjoyed going through it, and it is a little bit of a challenge to define league average for each position because they can get blurry. So I went with guys where it was pretty unambiguous, and the center for probably both of us is Rudy Gobert. Best rim protecting center in the league, talented pick and roll, big man now, good rebounder, power forward, unless you want to play him at center, Draymond Green, can do a lot of the little things. I struggle.
Does he
I don't know.
Count as, is he below average? I think he probably is.
He's at 32% this year, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess let's talk about this idea of below average or not. If you look at the qualifiers who have taken enough threes to be on the leaderboard, looking at like twos and threes, the median, which I think the median is maybe more useful than the average in something like this, because you're trying to think of just, you know, where is the average player in the league, not what is the overall average, if that makes sense. But I think that if you look at qualifiers, you're looking at 38% for twos and threes as the median. I don't think that that's necessarily the case, because there's a lot of bench guys who are like that. So I mean, I think like you, I kind of just decided to eyeball it a little bit. But if you're shooting below 35% and you haven't really ever been significantly above that in your career, that was kind of my criteria, basically 35%, 36%. That's usually about what the league average is overall.
So do you agree with my big men combination?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that this is a little more subjective, but yeah, that's who I would have gone with, Gobert and Draymond. And then John Wall was my point guard. I think he's always been a guy that's been talked about as not being a good enough shooter. Jimmy Butler at small forward, same thing. He's had some times where he shot well, but on very low samples, and for his career, I think he's like 32%. And then my shooting guard, I went with Josh Richardson, who has shot it well at times, not shooting it well this year so far. Shooting guard out of Miami, of course, and not a guy who's established himself that much as a three-point shooter. He was scorching hot last year, but not someone where you're like, okay, this guy's coming off screens and draining threes. And yeah, I think this team would be pretty good.
For point guard, for me, it boiled down to John Wall versus Russell Westbrook. Both good players. I thought Wall made more sense for this personnel, though I would enjoy
And Wall is also good at setting up three-pointers. Which,
exactly.
I mean, and so I think these guys, these are all guys who do enough other stuff, Draymond, Jimmy Butler, Richardson to an extent, and I know you haven't said your two yet, but if they were just like, all right, this is the team that I'm on, I really got to concentrate on this, like Draymond could probably shoot threes a lot better if he weren't on a team with three of the greatest three-point shooters of all time, and that was not his role, you know.
I'll go to the three and then to the two. At the three, for me, it was between Giannis and Jimmy Butler, and Giannis just felt a little bit duplicative. He's 29%, so he clearly fits in this. Jimmy Butler has a more versatile offensive game, so I went with him as well. I also like his defense, and I think think that he could work in the system. No issue with Giannis either. And then at the two, I went with Nicola Batum, who has not been as great of a three-point shooter kind of throughout his career as some might think.
He had too much of a history for me of being a good shooter. Like, he takes some pretty tough attempts. Like, he's got a pretty high volume. I know, like, the numbers on him are not great at times, but I thought that he's, like, too good to really be in the spirit of the question, at least for me. I
also love the idea of Batum on this team, because you could just switch so much stuff if you had three guys that are about the same height. It'd be awesome.
All right, let me finish up with a couple of other observations from Wow Good Stats here. He says, is there any reason not to get rid of things like 5 second closely guarded and 5 seconds backing down? 5 second closely guarded doesn't exist in the NBA. It never has in my lifetime. That's only in college and in high school. You needed that because either the shot clock was so long or it doesn't exist, which is a travesty, of course, in some high school state still. So you don't need that with a 24 second shot clock. And the 5 second back down, that was more of an issue before the zone defense really became more widely used. You know, Mark Jackson, Charles Barkley, when you just couldn't bring help at all, or you had to just run pell mell at the guy on a double team, very obviously, and then they could set up shooters, and you're not really doing anything other than just like using your big butt for 10 seconds to back down. I mean, you know, we'll see. I see no reason to get rid of it, though, because it gets called, you know, probably once every like 10 games. But yeah, I could see getting rid of it now that zone defense is there. But you never know how often guys would try to do that stuff if it weren't illegal. So, I mean, I think there's no reason to get rid of it. Like, do we really love to see guys back down into the post? Like, not really. What else did he have?
Another point that the same questioner brought up was that they felt that getting rid of offensive 3 seconds in the paint would help post play. That's probably true, but I also don't think it creates a more watchable product. And also with the way that teams are capably doubling post players now, I don't see the benefit in terms of the product.
Well, and what would happen if you got away from 3 seconds is you would always have whoever the biggest guy on the other team was, like Andre Drummond, just like standing right at the restricted area trying to post up all the time. Like, they put 3 seconds in for a reason. I think that rule should stay. I mean, frankly, like, I just love the product right now. The only thing that I really would like to see as far as rule changes are moving out the charge circle or reforming the charge rule, and then widening the court so that the corner three would be the same distance as everywhere else. Those are the only two things that I really would like to see in terms of major stuff. I mean, there obviously are tweaks that could be made. We'll talk more about some of those. All right, what do we got next here?
From Adam is interested, if you were the Nuggets, would you trade Yusuf Nurkic, and what team should try to acquire him at the deadline?
Well, we know the center market is very compacted right now. There's not really, I do think that young centers that are a little undervalued, Noel being another one, is one you could look at. This is now Nurkic's third year. He'll be extension eligible this summer. Yeah, I would try to move him because I think Jokic is the future. Nurkic, for what he's probably going to want, the fact that he's a little bit surly when he's not playing as much, the fact that backup centers are easier to acquire. I would certainly see what I could get for him, and there have been reports that that's the case. Now, what do you think is the value for him? Would you trade him for just, you know, a pretty middling first?
I don't think that I would. At this point,
well, he doesn't help them at all. That's what I'm saying. Like, I mean, unless Jokic is going to get injured, or you think suddenly Jokic isn't the answer? Like, the time to trade Nurkic is now while he's still on this rookie deal.
But will a middling first help them either?
I mean, at some point in the future, like, he's just if you had to guess, it's pretty unlikely that he's going to want to stay as a backup center. It's pretty unlikely that, you know, the best case scenario is what? You keep him, you really try to bargain hard with him in restricted free agency, force him to take some bad contract. He's still unhappy, and now he's your backup center for 18 minutes a game.
Basically, what is going to happen to Demo?
I mean, I think he's probably better than Demo. He doesn't have quite as many injury concerns. But, I mean, I would rather have, unless I'm like a championship contender, I'd rather have basically any first round pick than some guy who's going to be playing 18 minutes a game for my team. And yeah, this is the idea that he could potentially be a starting center, but he hasn't proven that. He's been injured. He has some issues in terms of his offensive efficiency in terms of being a little bit selfish offensively, defensive effort, all that stuff. Like, the time to move is now, because once it gets past this trade deadline, I don't know if you are going to get a first rounder for him. And I think there are some teams that might be interested in him. And the three that I thought of were Portland, just because, and I think teams that the type of team that would be interested in taking a chance on him, much like I think would make sense for someone like Noel, are teams that already that need a center, but are already kind of capped out, but in the playoffs already. And so you give yourself a little upside if he develops. And I didn't mean to like diminish what he potentially could be. I think he moves his feet well. He's got good length, can be a force on the boards. So I think he could be a solid starting center someday. And that's why a team like Portland, Washington, or Charlotte maybe should take a look at him and might consider trading a future, you know, lottery protected first rounder for him. Maybe not this year. And if I were the Nuggets, I probably would want it to be a couple of years in the future because they have so many young guys already.
And so many
picks coming already, too.
There are two other points with it. I think that he could be very useful on a team that has short-term cap space and is then going to be capped out because he's so cheap right now. You could maybe try to strike that balance. And along that line, a team that I thought of within also the fit of not needing a starter right now, but they could always benefit from it, is Brooklyn. So if Brooklyn theoretically gave up that Celtics pick, which is probably going to be mid-20s, they would get a player who can play minutes for them right now. He can contribute. And if he does well and you think he's better, then you can think again, as they basically have been for 7 years now, about trading Brook Lopez. And whether he becomes the starter or just a higher usage backup, he could help them.
Let's actually get to that Brook Lopez question right now. Dark Fantasy, are the reported 2 first round pick demands for Brook Lopez too high? Seems right.
Depends
about
on the quality of the pick. I mean, if you're, I don't think you can get 2 lottery picks for him, but something
no,
in
that
the,
would be insane. Yeah.
Yeah, but something in that. The like late teens and then something in the 20s. Yeah, I could see that. Depending on, I don't know who has that combination of assets right now, but over a couple of years, sure.
Now, too high is interesting, right? Because you can make the argument that with Brook only under contract for one more year, getting up there a little bit in age, going to have to be re-signed, the fact that there's this glut of centers, the fact that does he really help a contender with his defensive limitations? There aren't that many contenders that need centers. I understand all that. And so maybe his actual value, the most they could get for him, would only be 1 first round pick or a first round pick and, you know, a more middling prospect. And remember, you got to match the salaries too. So you're gonna have to, I mean, maybe it could be something along the lines of you get the 2 first round picks, you trade Lopez, but you're also giving a team like Portland some salary relief, you know, taking on Evan Turner or Alan Crabb once he's eligible to be traded to the Nets at the end of this season. Though Crabb is shooting 44% on threes, so I don't know if I necessarily want to move him if I were Portland. But nonetheless, if you're only going to get 1 first rounder for him and you're going to have to take back at least some salary, although maybe it can be shorter term, no, that's probably not enough for me to want to do the deal if I'm Brooklyn, even if it just means, hey, this is our only guy that's going to make us even semi-respectable and watchable the next year and a half. That to me is worth more as an organization than getting 1 first round pick. So I wouldn't trade him for that. So I wouldn't say the demands are too high. I understand why that's what they want. If that's not what's out there, then it just doesn't make sense to trade him, I think.
There are times where a player just isn't tradable because there can't be a meeting of the minds in terms of value. It happens all the time.
Mr. Fantasy also asks, what do you think of LeVert and Whitehead so far? LeVert, I actually did a pretty long breakdown on him on the last 15 and 60 that we did on the East about a week and a half ago. So you can go listen to that if you want to. You need more about Caris LeVert. Zach Lowe wrote about him and was enthused in his piece today. And Whitehead, you know, I don't think he's really a good enough shooter. He's shown some athleticism, which is nice. He's got a strong body. So there's some hope there, but I haven't seen much in terms of skill level playmaking to make me think that he's necessarily going to be anything as a guy who was drafted, I think, in the early 40s in what was a weak draft. But I mean, when you consider where he was drafted, and he's done okay, but I'm not like, I don't really, he hasn't shown enough where I'm like thinking that he's going to be awesome or anything, or even that he's going to be a solid rotation player. But he hasn't looked horrendous given where he's coming from.
To me, he's looked good enough to keep on a roster, but not good, but not good enough where you're freaking out that he's not in your rotation. Also, if you were freaking out about that, the Nets can just put him in your rotation.
What are you going to make for Blue Apron this week?
Excited about, I think it's coming in the next couple days, a pork chop with a garlic piccata. Sounds awesome with a rice dish going alongside it.
Piccata is very underrated. I've always liked piccata. I've never had pork piccata before, but chicken and veal are also good. We're going to make finally that chicken mozzarella with yellow tomato sauce tonight. That's really been waiting to do that. Just been had so many Warriors games and stuff. I haven't been home for dinner. We actually made Blue Apron for lunch last night. Blue Apron, if you're not familiar with it, and I'm guessing you probably are by this point because it's an excellent product. It's essentially a food delivery service that brings you all of the ingredients perfectly proportioned that you need to make really good home cooked meals. The instructions are very detailed, but easy to follow. And it'll take you between 25, 40, 45 minutes to make meals that I think are better than what you're going to be cooking at home, at least if you're anything like me as a cook, and probably even less expensive as well, because it's less than $10 a person for Blue Apron. Whereas if you go to a Whole Foods, you're going to have food waste. You're going to probably pay more for ingredients. Blue Apron's ingredients, I think, are excellent. They're all also sustainably sourced. They do a lot in terms of working with the local farmers. So the way to get started with Blue Apron, blueapron.com/capspace is the URL. Capspace is easy to remember because we talk about it all the time on the program. blueapron.com/capspace, and you get your first three meals free at Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Where did you want to go after this?
I think it's time to talk about Boogie again. And Saints Canucks, who clarified that they are a fan of the Saints and the Canucks, which amuses me, asked if DeMarcus Cousins really does sign a five-year extension with the Kings, what possible moves could you see the Kings making in the future to be able to consistently make the playoffs?
Oh, man. Well, they could have up to $40 million in space this summer. The problem is they would need a starting point guard. They would need a starting shooting guard. They would need a starting small forward. And they would need a starting power forward. That's
bad. But
they
have lots of centers.
Oh, man. I mean, and this is where, this summer is where it's really going to come home to roost just how badly they have drafted since Cousins. I mean, some of these picks, Jimmer Fredette, whom they actually somehow moved down to draft and gave up more assets. That was back in the Jeff Petrie era. They drafted Willie Cauley-Stein, another center next to Cousins who can't even play anyway. Ben McLemore is still completely out of the rotation in what is now year four for him. Who am I missing?
Stauskas,
not on the team anymore. He was part of them having to give up a first round pick to clear space. And then this year, I mean, at least if they had Marquise Chris on the roster, whom they could have drafted at eight, he's at least a power forward. He at least has shown some flashes. I think he at least has some upside. He's not the type of player the Kings have had a lot of success with, athletic guys who have a low basketball IQ, but at least he would be on the team. Maybe they're thinking that Bogdan Bogdanovich can come over and be their starting shooting guard, but they're going to have to pay him because he'll no longer be subject to the rookie scale 3 years after he was drafted. They got him in that deal. Scal hasn't done much in the D-League from what I've seen. Papa G, I mean, we know that he's years away and he's a center anyway, too. Malachi Richardson, we haven't seen anything from him, would be great. I mean, they haven't hit on anyone in the draft. Like, it's really remarkable. And they've had so many assets during that time period to not even be able to luck into one guy who could play in the draft. Oh, they did. Isaiah Thomas. And they let him go. And now he's
they got Seth Curry too and let him go.
Yeah. Yeah. He could be helping them a little bit as a backup point guard. Although backup point guard actually is, Collison's gonna be a free agent. Gay, Omri Caspi, even though he hasn't been playing as much. I mean, maybe they'll just keep Tolliver around because he's non-guaranteed for $8 million. Only like $1 million of that is guaranteed next year. Maybe he'll be your starting four, and now you're down to $30 million in space. But you still need three positions, and you could say, all right, Temple, he's $8 million, he's our starting shooting guard, and you still have nobody who can do anything off the dribble on the roster whatsoever. And if you do that, you're still got $30 million to get that up, get two starters, three starters in a market that's not really a good one. Yeah, I don't know what you can do at this point. I mean, maybe you can tank and then hope that you get someone with this draft pick, but that guy's not going to develop into a starter until 3 years from now. Maybe you trade that pick as well. They also owe that 2019 unprotected though to Philly, so if they wanted to make a move at the deadline, they could still trade what's left of their pick. They also, it's top 10 protected to the Bulls too. They also have to swap it with the Kings if they get like the number one pick or something, and it's to swap it with the Sixers. There's a reason why when we were asked like who has the darkest future of basically like any team in the league, now we answered that before this designated veteran extension thing came in, so we assumed they were going to lose Cousins. But in some ways having Cousins makes your future even darker because there's no way to even like draft and rebuild. I mean, they need to hit on like three first rounders in a row here to like, they have no assets.
Three first rounders in a row to hit on,
right? No, it's true. I mean, they could lose this pick, they could lose 2019.
it's a really tough situation, and I completely understand why DeMarcus Cousins looks like he's going to take the money, because it's the risk mitigation of this is gargantuan and the financial implications are huge. Plus, he's committing to the contract and committing to team control. He is not necessarily committing to the team itself. I covered the Golden State Warriors when Steven Jackson signed an extension and forced his way out. I've seen this happen before. It can be a part of this. And that is not only life-changing money, that's like family life-changing money. And he gets it more than a year in advance, and who knows where this is going to go.
So, Tanira M, I'm doing my best here to try to figure out how to exactly pronounce this handle, but asked as a supplement, do you think he will sign an extension? I think he probably will. But the question of what I would do in his position is an interesting one. If it were me, I would be trying to force a trade post-haste, just because my career is a-wasting. I realized that I could get this amazing extension for me personally. I mean, having already made probably $100 million in his career when you throw in endorsements as well. Yeah, granted, half of that's probably lost to taxes, but $50 million in the bank is fine for me. I think I could still sign. He's not really injury prone. He could still sign some massive extension with his new team. Wouldn't be necessarily designated player. He probably has to wait to be a free agent in 2018. But I would just want to get out of there immediately. And I would do absolutely everything I could to tank my trade value before that too, so whatever team I went to wouldn't have to give up too much in terms of assets. And I would just want to start my career and try to be on a winner. So that's what I would be trying to do. But that's me. I think the reality is of the amount of money that he could get a year early, and it's way more than he could get elsewhere, because once he gets traded, he can't sign that designated veteran extension. That probably, I mean, for the vast majority of people is like that. But, you know, personally, I don't know that I'm that much happier with $200 million in the bank than 50, but that's just my own personal way of looking at it.
I previously advocated for Anthony Davis to sign the qualifying offer, which is a much greater financial risk than what DeMarcus Cousins would be doing to get out of New Orleans.
That I couldn't advocate for, because that's like, you know, you get injured and it could be it for you. You haven't made anything in your career. He's already signed what was a max contract at the time. It's different for me. So you're even more extreme than I am in this
one. I am. And also, the perils of being traded and you don't know what the other situation is going to be are mitigated by the fact that it's not going to be worse than the Kings. The Kings are either the darkest or the second darkest timeline that exists in the NBA.
It cannot be worse. That's right. Yeah. So, and you could go somewhere else, test that out. You still would have bird rights to re-sign there, or you could just be a free agent then in 2018 and do your fate. It's much like the same way as Millsap. You would want to be traded to somewhere now where you can test it out, where you have bird rights, and then if it doesn't work there, you can still go elsewhere.
Especially if you can get traded to a team that wouldn't have been able to sign you in the first place, like Toronto.
From Kat, K-A-T, going to get that yarn. Of the players who did not get an extension from the 2013 draft and will come RFAs this summer, who will get the biggest contract and who still has the best upside? The three that came to mind here for me, KCP, Nerlens Noel, and Victor Oladipo. Is there anyone else that you would have considered in this analysis?
Oladipo Seriously. Got an extension.
Did he get an extension? Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot. Yeah, I was confusing our mock extension with...
That was a very contentious negotiation.
And it was. Yeah. All right. So it's basically KCP and Noel now, huh? Yeah.
Yeah. KCP, there isn't as much risk with him. We both love Nerlens Noel. Like, we're higher on Nerlens, but Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, especially now that he's been shooting this year, he has shown that he can kind of fill that 3-and-D role. Yeah. And
over
doing
40%
that
on threes so far this year.
What?
Over 40% on threes so far this year for KCP.
Plus, he can defend point guards, which is a value added. It's not necessary, but he does a good job on twos. But with certain alignments, that's really useful. Philly could offer him the max for the 4 year, like the Gordon Hayward style max. No problem. I would have no opposition to that. Nerlens, that sales pitch gets tougher just because of the injury history and because you're selling on potential rather than on production.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that Noel could certainly be better than KCP. And actually, we'll take this Noel question in a second. But yeah, KCP, I mean, I think if he doesn't get the max, he's going to be darn close to it unless this shoulder injury turns out to be a major thing. And you know what? Even so, he might still get there because there's just nobody who's young and good to throw your money at.
As long as it's not a long-term injury, it could weirdly help him, because if the Pistons fall off without him, and it locks in, it would lock in a high shooting percentage for the year.
Yeah, and we've been talking too about with Ben Simmons, I think that KCP is just about the perfect fit next to Simmons. Simmons runs the one on offense. KCP guards the one on defense. He can switch some. He's got great size. I think that could be a really nice combination. The Pistons are going to match no matter what happens, probably, but certainly could get it. Let's get to this other Noel question here. Actually, let me find that, because I don't think I put that in the outline, but I did want to get to it briefly. All right, here we go. DT Brooklyn. There's a debate among the value on the value of Nerlens Noel since he started playing major minutes on December 29th. Sixers, I've been fifth in defensive rating over the last six games. I'll trust Mr. Brooklyn on that. Offensive production has been limited. What is his value? What might he get in the summer as a restricted free agent? Could it even be a max offer?
I don't expect him to get a max unless he plays really well the rest of this year. The narrowing of teams that have that kind of money is really going to make it hard, even though the restricted situation is more palatable now than it was going to be before. A full max could be really, really tough for him. But at his ceiling, defensively, he's an immensely valuable player. He's worthy of a max. But the injury issues and the fact that that's a ceiling, not a median outcome, make it that it would be down from there.
Yeah, I haven't quite updated my numbers yet, but teams that could have some space... Sacramento is one, a terrible fit next to Cousins, I think. Not really Philly, but hard to imagine him going back there with Embiid still there. The Knicks could be a possibility if they just acknowledge that Noah is not working out as a starting center. The Lakers, same thing, another team that you just put in $60 million a year for Mozgov, but I think Noel actually would really fit into what they're trying to do, especially as a guy who can pass a little bit. The Pacers already have Miles Turner. Denver already has Nikola Jokic. Dallas may not have that much space, but he could be an option depending on what happens with Dirk.
How would you feel about a Noel Jokic combination?
Terrible. It's just another center. Like you're either going to play Noel on the perimeter and waste his skills, or you're going to play Jokic on the perimeter and get traffic coned all the time.
Okay.
And then offensively, by having another guy on the floor who can't shoot, the whole point of Jokic is you have this five out system where he can pick and pop, and he's got all the space to work with. You got guys going backdoor. Noel messes that up too. I guess there's Brooklyn, Boston, if they strike out, maybe they finally decide to use their space. Atlanta has Dwight Howard. Maybe if they moved Howard, they could get into that as another team that might have space. So yeah, these teams that have space.
You know what's going to really piss me off? If Nerlens makes enough money that he could have fit in Minnesota instead of Jang, because that's a much more cohesive fit than Jang, if they wanted to go to.
I still don't like him in Minnesota for the same reason that I don't like him in Denver. You know, the whole point of this awesome shooting center is not, oh yeah, now we can play him with the four and play another center next to him. It's we have this center who breaks defenses by being able to shoot threes and be aggressive off the dribble and post up on switches and be a great passer. So now let's like just put a bunch of smalls around him and kill people instead of just putting another big next to him because the guy happens to be able to shoot. Really, that philosophy kills me. Yeah. So I wouldn't necessarily like him that much in Minnesota. Miami could be a possibility if they were to move Whiteside. Maybe Milwaukee if they got off some money somehow, but that's even assuming that Monroe leaves. Not a ton of places really for him to go. Another actually, he's just not this type of guy. But what about San Antonio if Pau Gasol were to opt out?
It'd make me happy.
Yeah. So who knows? Maybe his market won't be that good, or maybe like Philly will just match and try to keep him around and, you know, on the idea that he's just going to play 20 minutes a game as backup center because they're trying to limit Embiid's minutes, which I would be doing over these next few years until they're really a contender. You might as well just like limit his minutes a little bit. I don't know. And then as to like what the demand will be for Noel, he's got to keep it together, not get hurt the rest of this time. Both the medical reports and some of the personality things that you hear are not amazing on him either. What's next here?
Since we just talked about them a little bit, from Vince 05051, do you think the Spurs are overachieving relative to their talent level? Is it simply a matter of consistent offensive execution and defensive effort?
Well, this is always difficult because is Kawhi Leonard overachieving? He's a great player. Is LaMarcus Aldridge? He's been a guy who's been, you know, probably a top 20, top 25 player in the league for a long time. Manu and Parker, well past their prime, but still smart guys who have been wonderful players. Dedmon, maybe you could say, is overachieving based on what he's been before. David Lee maybe is overachieving based on what he's done the last couple of years. Patty Mills, you could put in that. Danny Green, you could put in that. But I think a lot of it is just fit and recognizing what skills are important. Danny Green can play defense. He can't dribble to save his life. Not really much of a passer, but he shoots 40% on threes and he can defend 1 through 3. So that's, you found those skills. Even if he's not some great basketball player, when you put him in with a skills coach and ask him to do a bunch of step backs against air, he's a solid player. And so I think a lot of it is just finding the right fit. But with the players that they have, I think they could be, and also, like, you see how good their bench is on an annual basis. So that's maybe overachieving a little bit. But I mean, at some point, when a guy's been on a team long enough, what you're getting out of him is his talent level. And guys who have left there, you know, haven't just like fallen off a cliff either. You know, like Boban has actually been pretty decent this year. You know, when he's actually gotten to play, he was good last night against Golden State. So yeah, they have really good players and they have good coaching. I wouldn't say that they're really overachieving that well.
The only angle that I would say that they are is I do not think that their defense is, just on personnel, is top five good. Some of that is also that they're,
but if you look at what they do when those bad guys are on the floor, like when Pau Gasol, it's not good.
Correct.
And Parker a little bit less so, but he's a point guard and he actually has improved his effort a little bit over the last couple of years too.
And while they aren't as deep as, let's say, last year when they were absolutely ridiculous, they're still incredibly deep. I mean, Patty Mills is a fringe starting caliber player and they don't need him to be that because they have Tony Parker. Whether Parker, you know, Parker is a shell of what he used to be, but that combination is still great. Deadman has helped a lot. John Simmons, you know, was a find that we liked a lot and has grown into a larger role. They didn't even need some of those guys last year, but they have them. So yeah, I wouldn't say that they've overperformed their talent by any significant margin.
All right, new feature here as we're nearing the end. I'm going to just start a clock for 30 seconds each time we do one of these questions. You take one and I'll take one and we'll just won't respond to each other at all. We'll try and roll through one of these. I will start. Sour Asparagus, who are some players that you believe RPM overrates? And I will start right now. Nikola Jokic on defense, he's kind of slow. Their defense is not that good. His backups have been bad. Paul Millsap's another one. I don't think he's like a top 10 player the way he's been. Draymond Green is not a top 5 player in the league. Trevor Ariza is like number 16 right now. I'm sorry, he's not that good. Same thing with Otto Porter. Anybody who has a terrible backup is going to be overrated by RPM. And then some of these centers too, like Zaza is not, you know, a top 30 player in the league. Same thing with Bogut's defense last year.
From Papa Barnes 10, which NBA coaches have positively surprised you this season? Are there any new head coaches? I'm not going to answer that part because I don't know it well enough. Positively surprised, Alvin Gentry fully embracing Anthony Davis as a true center in the last couple weeks has been huge. They've actually had the second best defensive rating since they made that change. Luke Walton has been open to using their talent in different ways. I really do like that. Kenny Atkinson is running a new age system with Brooklyn, which has been great to watch, and I've been very excited with that. I think that's about it. I think that's about all for now, though the other coaches are doing a good job.
All right, that was a good 30 seconds there. Let me find one. I won't need 30 seconds on this one. Ethan Wind and Fire, are you excited for the new Big Three League of retired players? Do you envision this taking off as a league? Definitely not, and probably not. I want to watch NBA basketball. That's what I watch. I don't like college. I don't like other sports really that much anymore. I don't need to see a bunch of old dudes running around hoping they don't get injured.
Excited, no. Intrigued, yes. My next one will be from I think it's Kalel_Garcia. What took so long for NBA Hoops to fully embrace the three? College ball has been three happy for a long time, seemingly. I think a lot of it was just the idea that NBA teams were successful offensively in other ways. And then it took the Mavs and the Warriors and the Cavs just really thriving and creating an offense in that way. And also we're rewarding different skill sets out there now. So I think that it took the right players and it took coaches seeing it succeed at that level.
It's a really long shot. Guys had to practice it. It used to be all about getting to the closest shot that you could. If you look through the early 80s, guys were shooting like 20% on those shots. So once they started hitting it really well, then it became more of a weapon. Hey Diggs, why don't broadcasters use the end-to-end overhead camera angle more during half-court possessions? He likes it better for a number of reasons. I don't like it as much. There's a reason why sitting on the sideline costs you more than sitting on the baseline when you're at a game. I think that's because when you're looking forward and back, that's when it's hard to see perspective. You know, if there's a shot in the opposite corner, it's hard to see how close to the guy close out. And the most important real estate on the basketball court is closer to the hoop. So you want to be able to see side to side more easily, whether someone's closer to the hoop versus where they are width-wise on the court.
From Jacanzi, when you take into account defense, is Miles Turner having a better season than Porzingis or Towns? No. None of them are dominant defensively, and Towns and Porzingis are much better at this point offensively. Turner can use more of that toolbox. I think he'll get more comfortable with his three-pointer. I'm a huge fan of Miles Turner, but he hasn't been better than them so far this year.
Agreed on all counts there. Clockwork 42. Adam Silver said today the league is looking into ways to speed up the end of games. This will be our last one, by the way. What do you think of this idea? What changes would you like to see on this end? I think that reviews that clearly are obvious, like out of bounds and stuff, they should be able to do that more quickly. I think that clear path is horrendous. The rule itself is terrible, and then reviews for it are just as bad. You know, just obvious Euro fouls, leave that to the refs to figure it out. Maybe you could give coaches challenges, but I actually don't mind the end of the game that much because I like the drama to build. I like to get on Twitter, think about what they're going to run. If it all happens in 1 minute, it's like you can't build it up enough. And that's what really makes it so dramatic is, all right, we know the last shot is coming. Let's think about it for a minute or so. As long as there's just not too many of them, I don't mind the timeouts as much.
I'm more cognizant of it earlier in the game when it's not doing a lot, it's not building any drama. And can I throw up my, I think you've heard, Nate's heard it a million times, my idea about a fourth ref?
Yeah, it's right.
So my concept, I've tweeted this a few times, is that there should be a fourth official that just watches the television feed and can make rapid responses, like flagging a guy stepping out of bounds or something like that, just because they have the benefit of more camera angles. And I alluded to this, actually asked Coach Kerr a question yesterday about the idea of a time limit on reviews. For me, that would be more something for the fourth official. Like, if they can't make a decision in 15 to 20 seconds, then you keep it the way it was.
Yeah, that's a good one, right? Like, we want to eliminate the obvious missed calls. If it's
and also
close,
that person would be able, one of the big things that I want them to be able to do is assign a foul if it's done incorrectly as well, which gets into something Stan Van Gundy was complaining about yesterday, about that they sometimes they don't review the most important stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to the D-League showcase next week, and I'd be interested to take a look at, pay some more attention to the challenge system that I know they had last year, ask some people about how they like that and how that might be implemented. I mean, because you can even challenge, I think, like foul calls in the last few minutes of the game if you want to. You know, each coach gets one or something like that. I should know that a little bit better, but considering they're experimenting with it. All right, I think we're done here.
Oh, follow, can we do on one Twitter? Big question?
Yeah. Oh, what is
from,
it?
From Kemba 17, what was your favorite or the best NBA game you've ever seen?
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that one. All right, so here are the contenders for me that just off the top of my head. Two from last year, Oklahoma City, Golden State, Game 6, and then that awesome Game 7, Cleveland and Golden State, which, you know, I think we've talked about maybe the biggest game in NBA history, that Game 7.
I limited it only to games that I attended in person because it gets way too big when you start talking about everything that I've ever watched. And for me, there were two. One is the Game 7 you just talked about. And the second one is a forgotten gem, which was in November of 2013, the Warriors and Thunder played. This was the year after the Warriors made the playoffs for the first time. Both teams just threw absolute haymakers out there. And it ended with Russell Westbrook hitting what he thought was a game winner, doing his shooter celebration, and then Andre Iguodala coming back and hitting another game winner, which was absolutely ludicrous. It's still the only time I've ever seen that in a game I covered.
I want to say 2014 Miami and Golden State had a similar end to it, when LeBron hit like a crazy three-pointer from the left wing over Andre Iguodala after I want to say Steph had given Golden State the lead or at least tied it. But the other ones for me, I did not limit it to in person, maybe because I haven't been covering games as long as you, but two from my youth. This is a very underrated game, I think, historically. Game 5 of the 1993 Eastern Conference Finals between the Knicks and the Bulls. New York had won the first two at home. They had home court. It looked like they were going to, this was it for the Bulls team. New York had taken them to 7 the previous year. The Bulls, even though Jordan shot 3 of 18, won game 3 comfortably. Jordan put up 54 on just some ridiculous shot making in game 4, tied at 2-2. And this was, you know, it ended with the Charles Smith game, but that was a game that was just an absolute war, and decided that series, and the Bulls ended up winning it in 6. But the Bulls coming back from down 2-0 when it looked like things were really, you know, about it for them. Just a great game, like BJ Armstrong hit a key three-pointer from the corner as well, and then the way they finally stopped that Charles Smith Marv Albert, stopped again, you know, like that was just, that's like one of the great calls. Sorry if my Marv wasn't that good there, but that's a good one to end on. I would say probably though that game six, Oklahoma City, Golden State, it may just be too fresh in my memory right now, but just the incredible shot making, the crowd, the stakes of that, the fact that it was integral in KD coming to Golden State, that it seemed like now Golden State was going to get past and win the championship at the time. Although, and just because I thought the aesthetics of the actual basketball game were a little bit better, the great performances were a little bit better in that game six than the games over, but it's very, very close between those two for sure.
That game six is the only game from before the season that is still on my DVR. I've refused to delete it. I think I'm probably going to rewatch it before Durant's first game in Oklahoma City. I don't know if I'll record on it, but I want to talk about that. And that also inspired me to remember the greatest first half I've ever seen was a game, I believe, with you when Durant was facing the Warriors and was throwing all those haymakers until Mo Spates tried to take a charge at half court, and that led to the first of Durant's foot injuries.
I don't think it was half court. It was right at the rim on that play. But yeah, he undercut him, and Durant sprained his ankle on the same foot that he had the Jones fracture on. And then, you know, I'll have to ask him that sometime, whether that actually like contributed to it. I don't know if it'll ever, if he would tell me, but it was he had 30 in that first half, and OKC was up 20, and the Warriors actually came back and tied it by halftime in that game. That would actually be another fun game to go back and watch. But all right, yeah, I think that's enough of that question. Follow me on Twitter at NateTokenNBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. Twitter NBA show will be off next week, but we will, since I'm at the D-League Showcase, and we'll be back, I think, with the 15 and 60 on Sunday night, Eastern Conference edition. We'll talk to you all then.